Hello, this is Victor Gunatilaka, the frequency manager of PCJ Radio International, and this is program 0276, the stuff file with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0276. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have another visit from J.L. Witterick, the author of the inspirational book, It's Actually a Good Thing. What was the inspiration for writing the book?
We had to close the company that I founded, and people started asking me if I was okay about that. And I said, it's actually a good thing. And I really meant it, because I realized that there were so many things that I always wanted to do that I didn't have time to. And this was a great, a great gateway for me to pursue those things. And writing was one of them. So I started thinking about all the things that we think are bad that are actually good, and or good things in disguise. And I put them in the book. And when people read it, they tell me they actually feel good.
Relationship coach Frank Kerman is back to talk about relationships and social media.
Everybody has a different place where they draw the line. Everybody has different boundaries. One person may say, look, I don't want any of our private time together to be exposed to the world on social media. Other people say, look, I really don't care what you share in that respect, as long as you don't share some of the private details about the intimacy we shared, about any conversations or topic we may have had that should only stay between us.
Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter looks at the tarnished side of the glamour of Hollywood with Tinseltown. All the scandalous details are coming up on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0276 was Victor Gunatilaka, the frequency manager at PCJ Media in Colombo, Sri Lanka. Another place where you can hear the Stuff File program. Thank you very much, Victor, for doing the guest slate on this program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Officials at the Cincinnati Zoo said a pack of Grinchy squirrels are countering their holiday cheer by taking down their festive lights. Chad Yelton of the Cincinnati Zoo said squirrels gnaw on the LED light strands that workers put up for the holiday season, and the animals seem intent on keeping the facility's bare hill from being bathed in festive illumination. This is by far the number one spot for squirrels, Yelton said of Bear Hill. We've had many a night where it's completely dark. Yelton said the zoo lost 300 strands of lights in one recent year, and most of that was on Bear Hill. Officials said the squirrel problem has been going on for several years. Before the switch to LED lights, the squirrels would unscrew the incandescent bulbs, apparently mistaking them for nuts. Okay. Yelton said the zoo tried using hot sauce to deter the squirrels, but they kind of laughed at it. You know, it really didn't do much. I think we felt good about it, but it didn't do much, he said. Steve Foltz, director of horticulture at the zoo, said the yearly attempt to safeguard the holiday lights is a challenge of who's smarter, the squirrel or the horticulturists. Foltz admitted that, for the moment, the squirrels win. Really? I mean, how smart can a squirrel be? Let's go back for a moment to when the squirrels were unscrewing the incandescent bulbs because they thought they were nuts. Do you remember unscrewing incandescent Christmas bulbs when they were on? Those things get mighty hot. And you'd think if a squirrel tried eating one of those and realized that it wasn't a delectable treat, then message received. But I guess not. An unnamed man was backing out of his Aurora, Colorado driveway while smoking a cigarette. The lit cigarette dropped down the front of his jacket, so the driver jumped out of his van and tried to avoid being burned. In his haste, the man fell under the van and onto the driver's side, and the tire rolled over his head. Yeah, he was taken to hospital in critical condition but is expected to survive. Police do not anticipate any charges being filed and say alcohol was not a factor. Stories like that, and people still want to deny that there are dangers to smoking. A man approached a smoker outside a bar and tried to bum a cigarette. When the woman claimed to be out, the man repeated his demand with a gun, or rather something the woman thought was a gun until she spotted the orange foam dart in its barrel. She grabbed the gun from him and tossed it over the fence. The man then fled, but he returned. After a shoving match with one of the women's friends, he fled again, this time screaming for someone to call the cops, which someone did. Officers did find the suspect nearby and arrested the unnamed 22-year-old man for attempted robbery. Again, I'm trying to warn you about the dangers of smoking, but you're just not listening. And what else do we have in the Stuff File news for you here? Oh, yes, brave fathers-to-be are getting shocking lessons at a pioneering Chinese hospital in what it feels like for women to give birth. A nurse in the free lesson at Hangzhou Ema Maternity Hospital on China's Shandong province sends an electric current to a pad placed above the abdomen. Over 5 minutes, the strength of the current is increased, causing men to writhe in agony, according to witnesses. One man compared the pain to feeling as if his heart and lungs were being ripped out. Organizers hope the experience will make men more sensitive to their partners while they're in labor. It's an unusual exercise in a nation where men often don't attend the birth of their children. Hospital administrators emphasize that there's no lasting damage to men and also note that there's no real comparison between the pain experience camp and women suffering during a much longer lasting agony of childbirth. Some men couldn't hack it and bailed out mid-shock. I thought giving birth to a baby was something natural, something really normal that women could get through, one nearly dad told the BBC. After this, I realized it's not easy giving birth. It's just painful. Honestly, you know, is it really a nurse who wants men to experience what childbirth might be like, or is it just a nurse who likes to inflict pain? And on another note, is it really just like childbirth? Did this nurse try it on a woman who then said, yeah, that brings back memories? I'm willing to guess no. And we have one more snippet of Stuff File news before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A really tiny story. Because, you know, on this program, I love truck spills. If you've heard this program time and time again, I mention many truck spills because, for some reason, you know, as long as no one's hurt, they kind of amuse me. And this one seems to be the mother of all truck spills. A crash of three tractor trailers on Interstate 24 near Chattanooga, Tennessee, on November 9th, left a pileup of one truck's load of eggs, another's pallet of cheese, and another with boxes of meat. That sounds like one great highway omelet, doesn't it? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? J.L. Witterick is the author of It's Actually a Good Thing, a guidebook on how to put a positive spin on life's greatest challenges. We spoke to her last year when her first book, My Mother's Secret, came out. J.L., or Jenny, is back on the show and joins us once again on the line from Toronto. Hi, Jenny.
Hi there.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Now, the last time we spoke, we were talking about your book, My Mother's Secret, and you mentioned then that you weren't really a writer and you've never written a book before, and now you have your second book out.
Yeah, I sometimes life just does one of those turns on you, and I had such a great experience writing the first one. It's become an international bestseller in 9 countries, and schools are using it. So I just felt, you know, it was just incredible. I wanted to do it again.
So what was the genesis of this particular book? It's Actually a Good Thing.
Well, we had to close the company that I founded, and people started asking me if I was okay about that. And I said, it's actually a good thing. And I really meant it, because I realized that there were so many things that I always wanted to do that I didn't have time to. And this was a great, you know, sort of a great gateway for me to pursue those things, and writing was one of them. So I started thinking about all the things that we think are bad that are actually good, and or good things in disguise, and I put them in the book. And when people read it, they tell me they actually feel good.
Now, generally speaking, are you naturally a positive person?
I think I am, yes. It works for you if you are, because even if the reality or the event doesn't, you know, is the same, you're going to have a more positive interpretation of it. And what that translates into is just you're happier.
And going back to your first book, I remember when we spoke about your mother's secret. I mean, we talked about it then, the fact that you were writing a book about the Holocaust.
Yes.
And it itself was not a sad book.
No, everything that I do, I have an inspirational bent to it because I feel so strongly about that. I think that all of us, I think, you know, it's kind of like we eat in order to sustain our bodies, but we also need, I think, inspirational and a way of thinking to sustain, you know, our spirit.
So how do you convey that to someone who is more pessimistic, or is that even possible, or do you try?
Well, I think, you know, we all have our moments when we're down, and I don't think, I'm an exception to that. But there are ways to look at things which can work for you rather than against you. For example, if I'm walking down the street and I see somebody I know on the other side and I wave to them and they don't wave back, right? There's different ways to interpret what just happened. It's the same event regardless. But if I think to myself, wow, you know, like I'm just not worth waving to, I guess. All of a sudden you've got low self-esteem. Or that person never really liked me, I guess. And again, you know, that's going down a negative road. Or you could just say to yourself, you know what? It's too bad. They just didn't see me. No big deal. And it doesn't affect you at all. And so I think that you always have a choice in terms of how you interpret events, in terms of how it will affect you because of that interpretation. And so that's something that I wanted to share with people is once I discovered that, honestly, that just changed my life and got to a point where I don't really have to have a lot happen for me to be really happy. Like when I'm having a salad, I go, wow, you know, somebody had to plant all these vegetables. Somebody had to wash it, to cut it, put dressing on it. And I just get to eat it for like not that much, you know, it didn't cost that much to have all this. And all of a sudden I'm having a great day. All I did was have a salad. So I think that you actually can frame your life in a way that you always feel much better about what happens.
I think about that situation of somebody who crossed the street waving, and all I think of is, you know, I've got over 50-year-old eyes now, so that's just a waving blob over there. I don't know who it is.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's true. And most times it is true that somebody just didn't see you. But even if they didn't want to wave to you, wouldn't it just be more positive for yourself if you just interpreted it in a way that was harmless to you?
Yeah. I've often used the terminology, if I get over-obsessed or mad about somebody doing or not doing something that they might not even be aware of, all I'm doing is allowing them to live in my head rent-free.
Good point. That's very true.
Yeah. And they might even not know what they've done. I think of situations of people who go back to their, you know, their high school or their elementary school and meet somebody who is a perceived enemy, and that person has no clue that you're harboring or maybe harboring some sort of resentment for something that they may have done that they don't know.
That's just negative baggage, right, that harms you, as you say. So, you know, I try to really just take a positive bent on things. Like in the book, I say things like, don't have a nice car. And then I say, well, dents and scratches don't bother you, right? Because when you meet somebody who's just bought a new car, they're crazy, right? Oh, I can't park here. I got to walk 5 blocks because, you know, I don't want anybody around my car. And then a few years later, they don't care because now the car is, you know, worn down and there's some scratches on there already. They just don't care as much. And it's actually a freeing experience. So we try to put truth in the book as well as humor. And I think that's why people can identify with it.
Wow. I just got a new car.
Okay, well, let me choose another example.
No, but that's a perfect example. That is indeed a perfect example. Give us some other examples that you've written about in the book. It's actually
okay,
a good
thing.
Okay, so
this one is live beside a house that is so much nicer than yours. And then, you know, then the humor, well, this one's the humorous one, is like the robber is going to go to your neighbor first. which is something I heard way back when I was in business school. But, you know, I have something like short, because I am short, and then someone yells duck, and you're already there. So the baseball doesn't hit you, right? And you don't have to worry about low-hanging lights and stuff like that. So, you know, have a long-distance relationship, which some people do. Well, you know what? You don't really argue about things. Because I had one of those long-distance relationships, and you know, when you meet, the time is so precious that you don't want to spend it arguing about anything, so you just end up, you know, sort of having, you know, the time that you have, a higher quality time. And it was only after I moved back in the same city that I realized that we didn't actually agree on everything. And so wouldn't it be cool if you just lived your life that way, as if every moment was precious with the person that you're with, rather than when you just have a long-distance relationship and can only see them on the weekend? And so, you know, those are kinds of thoughts that I wanted to share with people.
You know, there's the old saying, it's like water off a duck's back. And I know the last time we talked, we touched on the fact that both of us are children of immigrants.
Yes.
And there's an immigrant mentality that lets things flow, that deals with hardships easier, I think, than others. Yeah. Is part of what you're talking about part of the upbringing you had?
Well, you know, I think that one of the greatest gifts my parents gave me was nothing. I know that sounds weird, but it really was, because I knew that I had to, you know, just, you know, really up my game, because it was up to me, and I had no fallback. You know, I had to, and in fact, in the book that I write, I have don't have a trust fund, and you flip the page over, and it says, you won't become lazy just sitting around waiting for those monthly checks. And it's true, actually. I work with, or I'm friends with, people who manage money for high net worth individuals, and they all tell me, without exception, that the kids that get all this money every month, they're not happier, because you've kind of robbed them of motivation and incentive to achieve for themselves. And so, you know, I think that that struggle is actually reversed for me now, because now, you know, I want to give my kid everything, because I didn't have anything, and it's actually the wrong thing to do. And even though I know it's the wrong thing to do, it's really hard not to do it.
This kind of reminds me of the story of the twins. One was optimistic, the two twins. One was optimistic, one was pessimistic.
Yeah.
And they're both shown to identical rooms, and both rooms are just filled with manure.
Yes.
And one of them goes in and he's very down about the whole idea of having to clean up this room. And the other one goes in optimistically and says, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere.
Yeah. Where is it? That's a great story. And I just think that there is a lot of negativity out there. I mean, all you have to do is listen to the news, right?
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be great if you could develop a mindset where it didn't penetrate you? You know, it didn't affect you. And one of the things that, in Asia, the lotus flower is very highly regarded. You see it in paintings and in symbols. And you know why the lotus flower is so well regarded? It's because the lotus flower is a beautiful flower that floats on the muddiest, dirtiest water, and yet it stays beautiful. It stays untouched by it all. And I think that's kind of a cool concept.
A book like this, it's actually a good thing. It might be actually the perfect holiday gift, because we're at a time of year when we're supposed to be more thankful and more aware of people around us and our surroundings, rather than more of the hype of dealing with the holidays.
Yeah, I think it's just something that you want to think about, is what you already have rather than what you don't have. And that's where this whole gratitude thing comes into play. In terms of what I discovered was that if I could, you know, develop a ritual where I just ask myself, you know, what are you grateful for today? It really changes my mindset. So yeah, I think that you're right. I think that if you can change somebody's mindset, you can change their reality. You can change their life. It's actually really powerful.
And it's actually a good thing.
It's actually a good thing. Yeah, that's right.
Jenny, I thank you once again for being on the program with us. It's such a treat to talk to you. Take care.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
J.L. Witterick, author of It's Actually a Good Thing. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0276, and you'll find the links to Jenny's website, and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. all this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test leader.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about relationships and social media. Plus, Stuart Nolman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And we do, of course, have an idiot of the day and lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, William Wilson scored when he bought a 7-year-old house in Cape Coral, Florida at auction for only $96,000 because its taxes hadn't been paid for several years. He had to buy it without inspecting it, so once the paperwork was finalized, he went in to clean it up. Inside, he found a mess. It looked like someone was packing to move, he said. There was a 3-year-old unopened mail. That was nothing, though, compared to the body he found in the bedroom. You couldn't tell who it was, Wilson said. It was so decomposed. You couldn't tell if it was a male or a female. Neighbors said an elderly woman had lived in the home, but they hadn't seen her for several years. It's sad about the whole thing, said a neighbor from across the street. Nobody ever checked in on her. Well, you're the neighbor across the street. Did you ever think to check in on her? I mean, honestly? And, well, the nerve of that woman, by the way, going off and dying and not paying her taxes. That'll teach her. Meanwhile, the sewage company behind Britain's first poo-powered biobus said the vehicle can run up to 186 miles on one tank of fuel from human and food waste. Genico, a subsidiary of Wessex Water, said the fuel for the 40-seat biobus is produced at a Bristol sewage treatment works where human waste and food unfit for consumption are put through a process to create biomethane. Mohammed Sadiq, the general manager at Genico, said the company is also producing biomethane for the country's natural gas network. We're able to produce enough biomethane to produce a significant supply of gas to the national gas network that's capable of powering almost 8,500 homes as well as fueling the biobus, Sadiq said. It takes the annual waste of about 5 people to create one tank of biomethane for the bus, officials said. The Bath Bus Company is running the biobus on a 20-mile A4 route between Bath, England, and the airport in Bristol, England. Okay, I have one question. Since there are times on a hot day when I don't like to drive behind some diesel-powered cars or a garbage truck, I need to know this. Just what kind of aroma comes off of that biobus? Because it can't be all lilacs and cinnamon. It just can't be. Meanwhile, 46-year-old Katerina Fioro Chaput went to the local American Legion post in Oxford, Massachusetts to confront the bartender who she accused of sleeping with her estranged husband. The woman told Katerina she was not allowed in the bar and had to leave. Katerina allegedly responded by hitting the bartender in the face and then grabbing the bartender's false teeth and yanking them out of her mouth. As the victim ran, Katerina then allegedly threw a beer bottle at her, which hit her. Naturally, the police were called in, and an official, or an officer rather, confronted Katerina to ask where the dentures were. She didn't have them, she told the officer. When the officer asked if he could search her belongings, Katerina pulled off of her vest and threw it down. Another officer picked it up and found the teeth in the pocket. The bartender must have planted them in my back pocket, she said. Wow. She has the lying prowess of a 3-year-old. Anyway, Katerina was arrested and charged with assault and battery and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, which was the beer bottle. Now, what I want to know is, how slow is the bartender? Because I can't see how someone can reach into your mouth and pull out your teeth in one fluid motion before you could defend yourself. Clearly, that bartender's bite is not worse than Katerina's bark. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a man in Naples, Florida called 911 to ask the dispatcher for a date. After being told that's not an appropriate use of the emergency line, the man persisted, asking the dispatcher if she was into handcuffs. When asked if he needed help, the man said yes, help getting off the alcohol. But he said he didn't want to go back to any alcohol treatment center since that's like jail. After the third such call from the man, an officer was sent to his house, where 45-year-old Stephen Ramsey admitted to the officer that he was looking for a date or escort service to help him pass the time. He was charged with misdemeanor abuse of the 911 system and taken to jail. And as you know, jail is such an awful place because it reminds him of rehab. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? When was the last time a fight broke out over a misunderstood comment you made via text message or social media? Did it destroy any relationships? Relationship coach Frank Kermit is back on the show to talk about social media and relationships. And he joins us on the line via Skype-to-Skype communications from right here in Montreal. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. It seems to be more and more people are tweeting and sending instant messages and sending text messages rather than talking to each other. And I'm guessing this can cause some problems.
Absolutely. It can definitely cause problems when you're dating somebody, when you're in relationships. The important thing to remember is that if an individual tweet or an individual post on social media is enough to completely stop a relationship in its tracks, probably wasn't a very good relationship to begin with.
Ah, good point. Good point. But what about people who aren't necessarily instant messaging or tweeting to each other, but tweeting about each other? I'm not saying that in a negative or nasty or nefarious kind of way. We can get to that later. But I'm talking about situations where people, you know, sometimes in a relationship, one party is say, more private than the other. You know, and if you're out there tweeting, I went out with so-and-so this week and we had a great time, and that other person says, you know, I don't want my business out on social media. That could be a problem too, could it not?
Absolutely. Everybody has a different place where they draw the line. Everybody has different boundaries. One person may say, look, I don't want any of our private time together to be exposed to the world on social media. Other people say, look, I really don't care what you share in that respect, as long as you don't share some of the private details about the intimacy we shared, about any conversations or topic we may have had that should only stay between us. And this is actually a problem for a number of people because they don't communicate their boundaries right away. Usually they start dating, and dating is all about fun as opposed to trying to figure out whether or not somebody can meet your needs and enter something more serious with you. So generally speaking, if there's something you don't want shared on social media, might not be the first few things that you share on a date. And if you are going to share them on a date, you need to be ready that the person that you're with may not understand the sensitivity of that information that they want to share along.
Good point. Now, should people getting into a new relationship, should they early on even discuss the idea of internet or social media boundaries?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's got to be one of the first topics of conversation on a first date. And it's not necessarily a, you know, finger wagging, look, I don't want you doing this or else. It might start off with a question. How active on social media are you? What do you normally post on things like Facebook? What type of things do you use Twitter for? These types of questions are very open-ended. You'll find out a lot about the person, and it creates a really casual environment where you can discuss certain topics. If somebody says, well, I post photos of my kids, I post photos of the day, whatever's going on at work, I may mention it, then that can lead to, well, what do you talk about when it comes to your dating life? How much do you share?
Right.
And then you get into, well, this is what I am comfortable with, this is what I'm not comfortable with. The more boundaries you have, the more you need to share and express that these are my concerns.
By the way, my first sign is when you go on a date with somebody and they snap a picture of the food you're eating, which to me is, I like to refer to it as food porn. There is not a single picture of anything I've ever eaten online, by the way. Just want to tell you that right now. And that to me is a big red flag.
Well, hold on. Let's be fair here. It may be a big red flag for you because you have a personal preference not to go that way.
Yeah.
For someone else, it may not deter them either way. Their attitude is, hey, it's a picture of food. You want to share that? Go ahead. There's worse things in the world. What I look at is, if that does happen, if the phone comes out, the photo of the food gets sent out to social media, the next question is, look, I'm very curious. Is there anything you don't post on social media?
Good question. Very good question. That would be mine, absolutely. Now, in this day and age, again, with social media, I'm sure this is something that has come up in with what you do, and I'm sure you have a strong opinion of it. People who break up or who fight through social media.
Happens a lot more often than it should. Generally speaking, you want to wait and keep your fights in person if you can. But, you know, before social media, when we only had telephones, people would fight over the phone as well. People will fight through whatever medium of communication is out there because fighting is a form of communication.
But at least when you're fighting over the phone, you are talking to each other. You're getting the nuances of the tonality of what's being said, whether it's being shouted or whether it's being said sarcastically or whether it's a calming situation. It's not just the words, it's the tone.
Whether or not it's just the words lacking the tone, it's still a fight.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about people who are upset and wanting to communicate the fact that they're upset, they're going to say and do things that may be misinterpreted. And yes, it is not the best way. Personally, when it comes to things like texting, always best to leave texting just for locations and very quick points, such as, we're meeting at this place at this time, right? Okay, thanks for the confirmation. You have to remember, though, that generations that are growing up with social media, that is a primary mode of communication for them, as just as generations who grew up on the telephone use the telephone for primary sources of communications. So that's going to happen. They are going to fight. They are going to reach out, make mistakes, and so on. The key here to remember, and this is probably the biggest lesson anyone can take away from this interview, never put anything in writing that you would not want repeated. At one time, you could feel comfortable saying, look, I may say something, but it's never going to come back to bite me. Well, when you put something in writing that you don't want passed around, shared around, and forwarded, it's a bit harder to do.
Absolutely. I miss the old days when you could argue via a tin can and a string. Now, with the other thing that I find nowadays happening with social media is not just one party arguing with another party via text messaging, but one party inviting the world into the argument, which I just don't understand this concept at all. You know, somebody putting on their Facebook page, I can't believe my boyfriend said this, or I can't believe my girlfriend did that.
Most people who do that are looking for support. They're looking for some kind of validation. If nothing else, they're trying to say, you see, I want other people to support me and say I'm right. Well, that, to me, is a major red flag.
That, to me, gets someone unfriended, personally, as far as I'm concerned.
More than that's somebody you would cut out of your life. That's someone you cut out of your life.
Exactly.
Look, these things go viral. It becomes a big joke. And the fact is, if you are having a fight with someone, going public with it doesn't reflect well on you. And it's not just that person that you had a fight with that you're going to lose. Anybody else that was thinking about you as a potential serious partners or somebody that says, you know, that's someone I might like to date one day if they're ever single again. Well, if the reason you became single is because of stuff you posted about your ex before they were your ex, you might have a lot of high-quality people saying, yeah, you see, I don't want to invite that into my love life.
Yeah. Going public with your fights, that's called the Jerry Springer show.
And you know what? Jerry Springer, a lot of them were staged. That's my understanding.
Absolutely. They'd have to be.
In these cases, this is not staged. This is people who are losing control and not realizing that there are consequences they cannot predict. You don't know who's going to be looking up your tweets and your posts in the future. It could be somebody who's looking to hire you for a very tough profession to break into, perhaps a profession that requires things like discretion, a profession that requires things like confidentiality. And if these are the types of things that you are posting on your social media network, it may not exactly represent you well when you're competing with a few dozen other people for the same position.
Is it more than just a generational thing and people using social media more than ever before and younger people using it as part of their daily lives all the time? Isn't it more something to do with some people just not understanding what boundaries are?
I would agree with that. With that said, when you grow up with it every day, it's hard for people to understand that there is such a thing as privacy, that there is such a thing as information that does not need to be shared.
Absolutely.
So people who grew up with the understanding, look, there's privacy, there's things you don't share with the world, they're the ones who really can't grasp this concept of social media. And anybody from that generation who already never understood the concepts of boundaries, they're just going to repeat the same behavior patterns with social media. Younger people nowadays don't even understand the basic concepts of copyright sometimes, because everything is, well, you just go ahead and download it. Yeah, but you know, there's that actually is hurting certain people in certain industries. Why? I don't understand, because it's always been there for them, and having to explain that to them changes things.
Interesting conversation indeed. Frank, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. People can find out more information by going to your website, franktalks.com. And what will they find there?
Oh, they're going to find a few hundred articles that I've written on the topic of dating and relationships. They're going to find a bunch of newsletters. I have various newsletters for people who are coping with loss, to people who are trying to stop being single, to people who are just trying to figure out how to move through the world of relationships, both monogamous and non-monogamous. Sign up for the newsletters. You get some free gifts. Sign up on the website and have a look at a lot of videos there too of my different media appearances, including this one.
Thank you very much, Frank, for being on the program once again.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, sir.
Relationship coach Frank Kermit. You can check out his website at franktalks.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0276, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Have you heard about the big lawsuit over the word how? A best-selling author and management consultant is suing the best-selling yogurt company in America, Chobani, over the yogurt maker's use of the word how in its marketing efforts. You see, Chobani emphasizes that how it makes its yogurt is different from how other companies make it by using the phrase how matters as the basis for its advertising. However, before they came up with that idea, the author and consultant who's suing them now wrote a book entitled How, Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. So he says Chobani stole his idea. Let's be fair, how we do things really does matter. Not only how we conduct business, but how we resolve conflicts. So this dispute is really a tremendous opportunity. Instead of battling before a judge like millions of others do, these parties could prove how truly different they are by resolving this out of court. How incredible would that be? Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And the Klieg lights are lighting up the night sky as we await the arrival of Stuart Nolman with Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. Well, I like the spotlights here and the the glitter and glamour here at Grauman's Chinese Theater for the premiere of the movie I'm about to release. This is kind of a thing that would happen in the 1920s. I mean, any other year, but the 1920s, a lot of Hollywood's most popular movies were premiered at Grauman's Chinese Theater. But you know what, Peter? The early days of Hollywood as a movie capital wasn't exactly an age of innocence. Because, you see, during the height of the silent movie era of the teens and 20s, Hollywood wasn't only cranking out two-reelers for every Nickelodeon and budding movie theater across North America. It was a haven for decadence, debauchery, and drug addiction for its first crop of movie stars.
And by the way, that's changed how?
The people are different.
Okay.
Okay, the people are different, and the cars are different, the clothing is different. But you know what? When the 1920s rolled around, though, the excesses practiced by many of these silent era stars started to catch up with them, much to damaging effect for many. There was the, for example, the rape murder trial of comedian Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle in 1921. Then in 1922 was the shooting death of film director William Desmond Taylor. And then there was the untimely death of morphine-addicted popular film actor Wallace Reid in 1923. But it's the middle incident and the scandalous ripple effects it caused that's the focus of William J. Mann's excellent book called Tinseltown.
And also the one that we hear, quite frankly, the least about of those three.
Yeah, but the thing is that there's a lot of people who are obsessed with that case, and there's even societies and groups and, for lack of a better term, fan clubs that deal with this case, which has been unsolved for over 90 years. Interesting, huh? But if you ask yourself who is William Desmond Taylor, if you're not an aficionado of Hollywood history, he was a very handsome and popular director who made a string of successful pictures for famous players Lasky, which was the precursor to Paramount Pictures, and was becoming a player in early Hollywood as a result of his role as president of the Motion Picture Directors Association. But when his prone body was found lying in the living room of his Hollywood bungalow on the morning of February 3rd, 1922, dead from a single gunshot wound, it started a scandal of monstrous proportions that would shake up the movie colony and precipitate a widespread campaign by politicians, studio chiefs, and church groups to clean up Hollywood from its immoral depths. So it's very interesting, but this case and its ripple effects take up the majority of the narrative of this book. Mann digs up the sordid affair that the murder case created, because Taylor had a shady past that included a previous marriage and a child whom he abandoned to go to Hollywood. And he had quote-unquote affairs with three Hollywood starlets. Mabel Normand, who was a big star with the Keystone Studios. There was Mary Miles Minter, who had the worst stage mother ever. Her name was Charlotte Shelby. And Margaret Gibby Gibson, who was picked up for prostitution early in her career and resorted to raising money through extortion schemes so she could raise money to make her own independent movie productions. But this murder, like I said before, has remained unsolved for 90 years. But Mann, through exhaustive research of police records and evidence, gives the reader a scenario of whom he believes fired the fatal shot at Taylor on that February night in 1922. And after reading through the book and what he has gathered, Mann's reconstruction of the murder and whom he believes committed it actually makes a lot of sense and can bring the case to a satisfying conclusion, which he believes was precipitated by a deathbed confession from Gibson back in 1964. And as a good side part of the book, he gives a secondary focus to the absolute power some of the early movie moguls had on industry at the time. In particular, he shines the spotlight on famous players Lasky founder Adolf Zucker, who came from Hungary, a poor Jewish refugee, and by the early 20s built a powerful movie empire in a way which he pulled all the strings in Hollywood at the time.
Well, without giving away anything as to who the author thinks the alleged perpetrator is... what I'm curious to know is when somebody comes out with all of this information and lays out the case this way and has in their mind a definitive answer as to who pulled the trigger.
Yeah.
We're talking about Hollywood here, and we're talking about the tentacles that Hollywood has.
Yeah.
Does the person that he points the finger at, do they have any heirs?
No, I think the alleged murderer has no future generations.
Okay.
And there's no repercussions like what happened during the case of murder when Zukor got people from his office to go to Taylor's home to seize all of his personal papers and keep them hidden in the bowels of the famous player's Lasky offices so the police or journalists wouldn't get their hands on them.
Wow.
Yeah. But let me tell you, Tinseltown is a fascinating book about the sad, tragic, near moral decline and fall of Hollywood during its infancy, which was accentuated by three major scandals that were filled with love, passion, drugs, and murder, and how the powers that be in the police precincts and boardrooms of the movie capital did everything humanly possible to bring back its glimmer and glamour, no matter what the cost was.
Sounds like a great idea for a movie, never mind a book.
Oh, yes.
And you know Hollywood loves to navel-gaze.
Oh, yes, and maybe one day they will.
Hmm. So the book is called?
It's called Tinseltown, Murder, Morphine, and Madness at the Dawn of Hollywood by William J. Mann. It's published by Harper, and it's $34.99.
And is there something else you could recommend in a similar vein? Yes. And may I take a guess at what one of those could be?
Well, you could.
I would guess something to do with the Black Dahlia.
No.
Oh, okay.
I have three books quickly. A Cast of Killers by Sidney Kirkpatrick was the first book that dealt with the Taylor murder case. Also, The Day the Laughter Died by David Yalop. It's about the Fatty Arbuckle case,
right,
which plays a minor role in this book, but albeit an important one. That's a great book. And also the one that that sort of like sparked interest in Hollywood scandals of the early days was Hollywood Babylon by Kenneth Anger, which was published back in the 70s. And for those people who read it at the time, who weren't aware of that Hollywood had this tarnished past, it's a great catalog of these scandals, including the three that I mentioned earlier in this review.
Actually, Hollywood Babylon is one of the ones that I have read.
Well, you have, and
it came out. It's a great book.
Yeah, quite an eye-opener.
Absolutely, absolutely. So no Black Dahlia, huh?
Right, no. Black Dahlia was like 20 years after this case.
Yeah, in the 30s, exactly. Or actually the 40s.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, sir, how can people get in contact with you? How can they find you?
Well, you could say under a short, shady tree, or under a palm tree and somewhere in California. But no, actually in the Montreal Times, in print every week, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Not under a palm tree with Jimmy Durante?
No, we're not even Mickey Rooney.
Okay. Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way and a few more Stuff File news stories right here, right now, on a program also heard, you know it, boys and girls, on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, Tony and Jan Jenkinson spent the night at the Broadway Hotel in Blackpool in the UK, and they didn't enjoy their stay, though, and left a negative review on the TripAdvisor website. They then discovered an additional charge of £100, that's about $155 US, on their credit card. The hotel says it's their policy to charge for bad reviews. Yeah. Despite the fact that repeat customers and couples love our hotel, your friends and family may not, the policy reads. For every bad review left on any website, the group organizer will be charged a maximum £100 per review. Gee, do they give a discount for good reviews? Wondering. The couple is seeking, needless to say, to have the charge reversed. The hotel management clearly thinks they have come up with a novel way to prevent bad reviews, North Trading Standards Area Manager John Greenbank said. However, we believe this could be deemed an unfair trading practice. Okay, so after initially reading this story, I dug a little deeper and checked the TripAdvisor website for other reviews of the Broadway Hotel in Blackpool. Yeah. If they charge £100 per bad review, they must be making a killing. Because, you know, I didn't see anything complimentary about the place. Also, I did manage to find Tony and Jen's review, complete with pictures. And believe me, the pictures clearly are worth 1,000 words. But the description of the hotel as a rotten, stinking hovel is priceless. I don't know how a place like this actually stays in business. And, you know, if anybody wants to go to TripAdvisor and weigh in with their two cents, I'm sure that Broadway Hotel would just love you to pieces. Yeah. Anyway, Santa Muerte, Our Lady of the Holy Death, might be described as a cynic's unauthorized byproduct of Roman Catholicism, currently festering in drug cartel roiled Mexico and Central America, and is, according to Vice Media, the world's fastest growing religion. Saint Death first appeared only 12 years ago in the Mexican city barrio of Tepito, and is now a first line of protection for worshippers in danger zones. Almost 80,000 Mexicans have been killed in drug-related violence since 2006, Vice reported. Said an author who has studied the religion, people feel more comfortable asking Santa Muerte for favors they probably shouldn't ask a Catholic saint for. Yeah. Well, you know, the Lord does work in mysterious ways. Speaking of which, Pope Francis ordered an investigation in October of the Italian Riviera Diocese of Bishop Mario Oliveri, who is 70 years old, and who is known for giving second chances to wayward priests from across the country. Reports had surfaced that among Mario's priests was one who openly published nude selfies on Facebook, another caught publicly flirting with the wife of a port captain, another dismissed from a cruise ship for molesting passengers, and another revealed to have a full-body tribal tattoo that he had exhibited while posing with a tattoo artist in the local newspaper. The manager of a church charity in the diocese estimated that about half of the bishop's 175 priests were delinquents. Well, again, the Lord does work in mysterious ways. And clearly at times, so does the Catholic Church. Anyway, we've come to the end of the line. Terminus, everybody out. But before we go, we have time for one more item. And you know what that is, boys and girls. Yes, it's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff off presents the Idiot of the Day.
An Arkansas teenager's attempt to land a driver's license landed him in jail after he was charged with driving to the test site without a license and smashing into a state trooper's patrol car and a house when trying to flee. 19-year-old Demontre Wright was seen by police driving himself to a test site in Jonesboro in the northeastern part of the state. But when a state trooper approached Wright to issue a citation for driving without a license, the teenager fled. Wright's vehicle then struck a state police car, causing minor damage. With state and local officers in high-speed pursuit, Wright attempted to navigate an intersection but lost control of his car and plowed into a residence. Damage to the house was estimated at $20,000. Wright, who was not injured, was taken to jail on charges including felony fleeing. Police said the license plate on Wright's car had been reported stolen. As for when Wright might actually take the driver's license test, well, according to Bill Sadler, spokesman for the Arkansas State Police, that will be addressed when he's released from jail and any fines paid. Okay, this is where I usually recap the litany of transgressions that someone has made before I declare their title. But seriously, why waste the time? This guy is as dumb as a brick. And the reason he is, well, because he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0276. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0276. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com. KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.